Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
As a listener to this podcast, you might often fantasize about your ideal cabinet, who you'd have as Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary, Chancellor or Home Secretary. But have you ever had that thought, but with beer? Thanks to our friends at Beer 52, you can create your own cabinet of beers. You get a free case of 8 craft beers, and all you have to do is cover the postage of £5.95. So go to beer52.com/party, that's the word beer, the numbers 5 and 2.com/party, and get your free case of 8 beers. And you can arrange them however you like. You can create a cabinet, or depending on your political leanings, a shadow cabinet, or just leave them in the cabinet. And of course, the joy of a Beer 52 monthly subscription is that you can have a reshuffle every month, which would still make it more stable than most of the governments we have in the UK. It comes with a magazine and a snack, and if you don't like dark beer, you can choose the light option. You can pause or cancel at any time. So if you want to bring some stability and you don't fancy a reshuffle, you can indeed lead by example. Go to beer52.com/party and pay £5.95 postage to get all this now. Hello and welcome to a very special episode of The Political Party featuring Margaret Beckett. I've just finished recording this episode and just am beaming at what a treat it was to spend that time in the presence of someone with such phenomenal political experience and someone who is still playing a leading role in British politics. It is so rare to have had the career that Margaret Beckett has had, and I feel very similar to how I felt after interviewing Michael Heseltine. When people stay in politics for so long and amass that amazing experience of different leaders of periods in government and opposition, different periods in government and opposition, they see so much of politics from a top level. They know what it takes. That gives them a unique perspective. And just as Michael Heseltine was able to give that from the Conservative point of view, this feels like the Labour equivalent, that long view, that wisdom amassed over years and years and years at a senior level. And at a senior level, because Margaret Beckett is one of the most talented politicians the country has ever produced and has her own style, and all this comes through. So this is a phenomenal collection of insight, of story, of reflection, of wisdom. So many great things. And I'm just, oh man, every episode of this is a treat to me. And making them during lockdown has been especially true. Although I do miss doing them live. I think there's something really special about making these in front of a live audience. But that these amazing people give their time freely to chew it over, to answer any question I might come up with, and give us the benefit, share with us all the benefit of that top level political experience is just, for an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes, I was just in a different world. I was just right there with Margaret Beckett, with John Smith, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, in the corridors of power. You know, just, there's so much in this. I really hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed making it, because it's just, Margaret Beckett is just, this is just great. You can email the show with any reflections you might have, any guest suggestions, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Always let me know where you listen. Richard got in touch. He said, thank you for a fascinating listen this morning as I journey around a static M25. Well, Richard, I have barely left the flat during this last year. So it sounds as if, though, actually, if you're on the M25, you're probably more stationary than I've been. So commiserations if you're still out there somewhere in the darkness. He said, I had to share my similar, should have sat on my hands, first Labour ward meeting to the one that Dave Rowntree told. And we had some fantastic messages about having Dave on the show, a very popular guest. Anyway, Richard says it was the Bellenden ward at the Dulwich and West Norwood constituency. Bored with shouting at the TV on Question Time on a Thursday night, he was invited to attend. There were 210 members in the ward, 12 of them attended, and poor old Richard, he said he hadn't realised the positions were not really up for re-election, and he walked away as Secretary, Distribution Officer and GC Delegate. Well, by all means, please share your first political experience stories. Email them to politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. It's time now to enter just this amazing... It's not a time capsule because Margaret Beckett is still a senior politician in British politics and has a senior role. But so much of this obviously is Labour history, and it's just magical. I began by addressing this with Margaret. I said she's had so many top-level jobs it was hard to know where to start. But I began really with an observation as much of a question. She's probably the most experienced politician in the country.
Oh, no, I don't think that's quite fair. There are other people around. But maybe still active, one of the more experienced in the Labour Party, certainly.
I mean, there can't be many people in Parliament whose CV comes anywhere close to yours. You know, you think about even that first government job as a whip for Harold Wilson. You know, you span so many different eras.
I try not to overdo it, although I'm sure I do. But I must admit, I do occasionally take a mild amount of satisfaction in saying something like, well, when I came to work for the Labour Party in 1970, to a room full of people who weren't even born in 1970.
It just goes to show, I mean, surviving in politics and enduring in politics is really hard. And I remember interviewing Charles Clark years ago, and he was reflecting on the reputation of Tony Benn. And he said, well, everyone's a national treasure if they live long enough. Do you feel you've achieved national treasure status yet?
No, I don't feel that, but I do take his point, yes.
I mean, there's so many places where we could start, but I didn't want to do it entirely chronologically. There are some really interesting moments in your career that I thought it'd be great to sort of start off with. First one being becoming deputy leader of the Labour Party in 1992, and just in the aftermath of that 1992, it's a shame to talk about defeat, but I guess if we're talking about Labour politics, there are a fair few to kind of pour over.
Yes.
But in 1992, in that election, you're one of the major players for Labour in that. You're the trade, the industry spokesperson. That's a really big brief to be holding when the economy is such a big issue for Labour for trying to win over Conservative voters. So much analysis about that 1992 campaign and the things that went right and the things that went wrong. Did you at any point in 1992 deep down think Labour were going to win?
I'll be perfectly honest, it was a mixture. On the one hand, it looked as if, and it felt as if, potentially we could win. And then you looked at the list of seats that we had to win to do so, and you kind of thought, don't know about that. But of course, the opinion polls were completely wrong. The opinion polls had completely misread. I think what it was is they make a judgment about where to put the people who say they don't know or they don't seem to want to say. And they got that judgment totally wrong.
I mean, there are so many exercises since Brexit being one of them where how pollsters, you're absolutely right, categorise people that aren't sure or aren't sure if they're going to vote seems to be crucial in really understanding the mood of the country. So Labour sadly lose in 1992. I mean, it's really hard now knowing what happens next, where Labour then have this sort of glorious period in government. But in the aftermath of that election, there were people who genuinely thought Labour would never win again. Were you one of them?
No, I wasn't. In fact, I was very... Our then agent, who was a lovely man, actually, and who I was very fond of, actually said, you know, Labour will never win again. I was furious. I didn't tear a strip off him, but I was livid. Because, I didn't believe it. But I will tell you one thing. When we were elected, John and I, because we'd been the Treasury, the centre bit of the Treasury team, and we were looking forward to the party conference, and we were concerned it would be a bloodbath, not assuming, hoping it wouldn't be, but you know, what's going to happen? Are we all going to get completely hammered? And then, of course, and I said this in the PLP after the 2019 election. If you look at what happened, the difference between where we were on election day in 1992 and where we were a few months later, the world was completely transformed because the Tories had taken us into the exchange rate mechanism and they fell out of it, which was spectacularly bad news economically. And so by the time we got to party conference, so we're talking about from sort of June to September, everybody could see that we'd told the truth about the economy and the Tories had told a pack of lies about the state of the economy, which, of course, they hoped if they were elected to be able to cover up, but they couldn't. And I said that to the PLP, as I say, in January. You know, you never know what's going to happen. Something can be round the corner. not envisaging the circumstances we're in now.
No. John Smith becomes the leader of the Labour Party in 1992. You become his deputy. So you stand for the deputy leadership in 1992. You beat John Prescott. Mm. And you beat Brian Gould, who stands for the deputy and for the leadership. Mm. Something that you would do as well. We'll come to that. So at that point in 1992, it's not sort of inconceivable that for you, you think, well, I'll stand for the deputy leadership. And then obviously you do stand for the leadership in 2 years after that. At that point, you're a pretty ambitious senior member of Labour's front bench. You know, at that point, you must have thought it wasn't inconceivable that within the coming years, you'd end up leading Labour yourself.
To be honest, that didn't cross my mind at that moment in time. But there's one thing that you probably don't know, and John Prescott will probably never forgive me for saying this, but I actually didn't want to be the deputy leader. It's a terrible job. And I'd seen Roy Hattersley going around, you know, being the person who was stuck on the television at 2 o'clock in the morning after every terrible by-election and going around to every dog hanging there was and so on. I was like, oh, you know. And I mean, what happened was that the BBC got hold of, I don't know whether it was a guess or whatever, but anyway, they put out a story saying that John and I were running as a team for leader and deputy leader. And we weren't at all. We hadn't discussed it. And as I said, I didn't want to be. I hadn't thought about being deputy leader. And so we rang the BBC and said, you know, you got this completely wrong. Because what was worrying me was if somebody else became the deputy leader and John had to work with them and they thought they weren't John's choice, that would not be good. That was not a good way to start. So I wanted to knock it on the head straight away. No, we're not running as a team. So that happened. And then my phone rang a little while later, and it was one of my parliamentary colleagues. I won't name him to preserve his innocence. But and he said, you know, this leadership thing, I heard it on the BBC. And I said, yeah, I've told the BBC, you know, they've got it wrong. I'm not running for the deputy leadership. And he said, that's why I've rung you, because what I want to know is why not? And after that, the phone just kept going and going and going. All sorts of senior figures in the party and so on, all saying, what do you mean you're not running for the day? Why aren't you running to be the deputy leader? So in the end, on the Monday morning, I went into the office and John and I had offices opposite each other. And John came in and he said, I've come to tell you that you've got to run to be deputy leader, but I gather you've already decided to do it.
But he says this.
So no, I didn't get down to thinking about being leader. I was, you know, sufficiently sort of, oh dear, do I have to do this?
It seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but when the history of the Labour Party and the present of the Labour Party is so bogged down in factions and cliques and sides and wings, you've always had, it seems, a unique gift for staying out of all that. I mean, was that a conscious decision on your part?
I don't know. I mean, oh dear, sorry, that's my phone.
Saved by the bell.
Yeah, oh, and it's actually the call I ought to take. Is that all right with you?
Of course, yeah.
Sorry about that.
No worries at all. The occasional interruption's understandable these days. In the olden days, I'd have joked that was Milbank on the phone there, Margaret.
Well, funnily enough, it was close to it. It is a Labour Party thing I'm trying to help organise, or getting stuck with doing it because I'm the person who's got the relevant phone number. I'll put this on silent.
Before we come on to New Labour and Milbank and that whole thing, the thing I was asking you was about how you'd always seem to manage to stay above all the different clans and cliques and wings and things.
Well, I don't know that everybody would, I don't know that everybody in the Labour Party would agree with that. I mean, I was immensely flattered many years ago when the National Executive Committee was different from how it is now, and there was a women's section that was elected by the whole conference and the unions and so on all together. And there were various of us in competition. And I remember one of my colleagues who would be pleased to be described as a right winger, who was campaigning for other candidates. And I heard that he was telling delegates who were committed to vote for me or for Claire Short that, you know, not to, but if they had to, because that was the mandate from their constituency, they should vote for Claire Short because I was much more trouble. Immensely flattered. Claire would have been deeply insulted. I was very flattered.
That must have been a while ago now.
Well, it was a while ago, yes. But what I was about to say before I thought of that was, I was in the Tribune group from the beginning. And when I was re-elected in 1983, I joined the campaign group and with a whole lot of people from the, you know, the old Tribune group like Joe Richardson and so on, we were in the campaign group for a while. And then unfortunately, the campaign group decided that they wanted to run Tony Benn as a candidate against Neil. And we thought that was a really bad idea. So, half a dozen or so of us left and got a different grouping to meet and talk about politics from time to time, you know. So I always regarded myself as being on the left, and I was usually regarded as being on the left by other people. And some people said soft left, some people said centre left, some people said hard line. People put you in different boxes according to their convenience. You yourself probably don't necessarily change all that much, but you moved about the scene. But if I don't seem to have got involved in faction fighting, I'm glad.
And do you think, I mean, the sort of old cliches, even for people not involved in politics, that people drift right as they go through life or that people mellow? Obviously, a lot of Labour people of your generation went on a journey from the left to perhaps closer to the centre. Do you feel that your views changed at all? Did you ever feel a mellowing politically?
I mean, my views about Europe changed, but then that's because Europe changed. I mean, dramatically, from when I campaigned against us joining to when I campaigned for us staying in, unsuccessfully on both occasions. Melanie Phillips interviewed me. I don't quite remember when. It's some years ago now. But I mean, it's in that this part of my life when, you know, a lot of people had moved, as you say. And she had interviewed me as a junior minister under Harold Wilson, many in the 70s. And she, one of the first things she said to me was, I've been reading, you know, all these years about stories about how you've changed, all this kind of thing. She said, I've been looking at it, and it doesn't seem to me that you've changed particularly at all. She said, you know, it seems to me you're very much the person that you were when I interviewed you all those years ago, with very similar views to the ones that you held then. So how do you account for the fact that in the meantime you've been, you know, described as hard left and all kinds of things? You know, ask other people is the only answer to that. So I don't think I'm wrong in thinking that I've been pretty consistent on the whole in my views. But obviously what you can... I've always been very keen to move as far as you possibly can in the direction you want to go in. But sometimes that means you've got to accept you're not going to go all the way. But how much can we get? Get as much as you can.
It's a very pragmatic view that, it's not just a Labour issue. Many politicians in many political parties could learn a little from.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'll tell you one interesting thing, which you almost certainly don't know because it got pretty almost no publicity at the time. But, I mean, I didn't join CND when I was a teenager because everybody was doing it. It was fashionable, and I never really liked doing what was fashionable. But I did join the CND, and I was in it for a long time until I became of the... it seemed to me CND had gone pacifist, and I've never been a pacifist. It'd be nice to be, but I'm not. And so at that point, I sort of let my subscription lapse. But I'm very pleased and proud of the fact that almost the last thing I did on the last weekend of being Foreign Secretary was to commit the then government to the pursuit of a complete nuclear disarmament, multilateral nuclear, because when I was in my teens, multilateral nuclear disarmament seemed completely impossible. You know, it was regarded as a get out. It meant you didn't really mean it. But by then, we'd had all kinds of disarmament moves. But I was able, as Foreign Secretary, to commit, and we were the first government, because it was before Obama spoke, we were the first government of a nuclear-armed country to commit to the pursuit of full nuclear disarmament while in office. Lots of people made the commitments when they'd left office or before they were in office, but this was the first time. And everybody was behind it, Tony and Gordon and so on. At that point in time, it was thought that we might make real progress that year at the Non-Proliferation Treaty Conference. But in the end, it didn't come to anything. But, you know, so it seems to me that's a degree of political consistency.
Well, and it's also a huge personal success. I mean, there are very few politicians that can point to even small things on the statute book that they influenced. That's something that in time may, you know, be something that saves the planet.
Well, let's hope so. But I think probably my greatest political success must have been to be the Secretary of State who introduced the national minimum wage, because everybody else did it. I mean, if you look at people's, the number of people who say it was their proudest achievement was to introduce the national minimum wage. I won't name any names. But it must have been my greatest achievement.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because it's huge and it's one of the earliest founding pledges of the Labour Party.
I mean, our first manifesto. There are lots of things people don't want to hear about the Blair government. But one of them is that in that very first manifesto, we committed ourselves to get rid of hereditary peers.
Yep.
And we committed ourselves to a national minimum wage. And through the whole history of the Labour Party, that happened in the Blair government.
Who'd have thought
it? By the way, I did both of them. legislatively, both of them were me and others, obviously. I mean, there were a lot of people involved in the Lords thing. And when it came to the minimum wage, Ian McCartney was the man who did all the spade work. But I did the politics at the end, without which it would not have come out the way it did.
Well, there are two great things to talk about. Just while we were on kind of security issues and left-wing histories, I remember around 1997, even though I was at school, they may have been apocryphal tales of Labour ministers coming into government and discovering that MI5 had files on them, and would they or would they not? Was Jack Straw going to look at his? Do you ever know if there was a file on you? And if so, were you ever able to peek at it?
I've no idea. I never asked, actually. I didn't particularly care. So, no, I don't know.
As chair of the Joint Committee on National Security Strategy, you may be able to have a peek now.
Well, I don't think that's the remit of my committee. When I was chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, I might have asked, I suppose. Or indeed, I was never responsible for MI5. It was MI6 that you're responsible for in the Foreign Office. I suppose it'd be interesting. I've never looked at my entry on Wikipedia either. I think I would get too upset about the inaccuracies and want to change things. So I think just leave it alone.
I mean, that shows remarkable personal restraint, particularly for a politician. You know, there's so much out there about you. How have you never succumbed to temptation and had a quick look?
Well, I have such a passion for accuracy that it would drive me crazy if people kept saying things that were complete rubbish.
So I had a look at your Wikipedia page earlier, and I didn't know you'd won the 100 metres in the 1992 Olympics. I mean, I was going to come on to that.
That's what I mean.
Well, it's fine if the inaccuracies are positive, I suppose. It's only the ones that are perhaps less so. But, I did have a look. It didn't seem to me that there was anything wild on there. So if that is a note of reassurance you can take some comfort from, then so be it. But those two things, as you say, the minimum wage and the House of Lords reform, founding principles. You know, the Labour Party is founded in Farringdon in 1900. It's not until Margaret Beckett is in the cabinet that it is able to affect those changes. It had formed governments before then, but the minimum wage and House of Lords reform had evaded it. The minimum wage in particular, not only as a point of principle, was a huge deal, but it felt, you know, when, and I don't know whether you feel the same, but when, and you hinted at this, when people talk about the Blair era as being almost a continuity Thatcher government, the minimum wage is always the first thing that I would cite as a former member of staff as proof that the Tories would never have brought that in.
The people who say those things have no recollection of Margaret Thatcher's government. I mean, one of the advantages I have in my life is that I spent 5 years shadowing Social Security when Margaret Thatcher was in power, and then followed by John Major. And I mean, with it, they were cutting benefits to the poor and the disabled every year. And on 1 year, they had a big piece of Social Security legislation. They literally cut every benefit from the maternity grant to the death grant, taking in widows along the way and people with disabilities. And people say, we weren't any different than that. Come on.
So when you're setting the minimum wage, and this is purely off memory, I think it was set at £3.60 an hour and £3.20 for the under 21s or something like that. And I think the trade unions wanted it to be around £5 an hour. I know there was a low pay commission set up and things like that. When you're bringing in something like that, and there was obviously huge resistance to it, not just from the Conservative Party and elements of the media, but elements of the business community and small businesses who are worried they might not be able to pay this thing. How do you set a rate that is fair to all sides? And what were the decisions that went behind?
That was part of the genius of the plan. We didn't set the rate. The Low Pay Commission did. And the Low Pay Commission had representatives from, you know, people who studied, people who were economists, people who were from the business community, people who were from the trades unions. They set the rate, or they recommended the rate. And that was a very good thing. But to be fair to everybody, I mean, the reason it took so long was because there was huge opposition to it in the trade union movement for a long time. And it was Unison, it was a campaigner. I've forgotten his second name. Bernard was the AGS of what is now Unison and was then Newpey. He was a brilliant campaigner, lovely man. Fought tooth and nail. And that union, Alan as well, I mean, the whole swathe of people in the leadership of that union fought within the trades union movement to get acceptance of the principle. So by the time we got to the Blair government, within the labour movement, the principle had been accepted and it was policy. And a lot of people in the business community had begun to see, because, you know, there were all those terrible scandals of people earning £1 an hour or sometimes even less.
Yeah.
So there was a distinct feeling. The Conservative Party fought it hard, of course, but the business community as a whole, now you are right, there are lots of people in the small business community who were worried about it, and that's completely understandable. But the business community had accepted it. It was only the Conservative Party who were really tooth and nail approach. They claimed it would cost 2 million jobs, which was all complete nonsense. And one of the things one of the reasons I remember it so well is because I was being driven by a very nice guy. All my drivers were lovely. But he said to me the week that it came in that they had a family friend, a woman on fairly low pay. And that when the minimum wage came in, she got something like an extra £100, £150 a month. And, you know, when your income is at rock bottom as theirs was, that is a life transforming change.
And twinned with things like tax credits, for the people that benefited from both, it was a huge redistributive early success for Labour.
Yep.
That first term and your memories of that, I mean, it's almost like reminiscing about a cup final or, you know, the Beatles in a way. But 1997, particularly for people like you that had served under a previous Labour administration and then had that whole period in opposition and all the heartache that goes with that, to win and to win so big. And it's an election victory like no other, really, in British history. It hasn't been surpassed since. What are your memories of that time and of that night?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, the night, we were stuck in our own count. We didn't get a result until 4 o'clock in the morning. So it was all going on, but not in my constituency. But one of the things I do vividly remember, well, two things in particular I'd pick out. First of all, we'd collapsed into bed, the thing being over, and the phone went about 1 o'clock, I think it was. And they said, could you be in Downing Street at 5:30? I suppose I could. And at 6:30, I was in the Department of Trade and Industries, Secretary of State. That's perhaps a slight exaggeration, but not much. So I remember that. But the other thing I remember, I think it was might have been the next day, but I remember I was coming down the Whitehall in my ministerial car, there was a woman in the car, and it was quite heavy traffic. The woman in the car alongside looked round, saw me, and she grabbed a red jacket from next to her and waved it frantically. And shortly afterwards, I had to go. I carried out an engagement that had been made by my predecessor to do an industrial visit, trade visit to Japan. But it was very shortly after, and they invited me up into the cockpit, and the pilot said to me, you know, we were away when the election day happened. He said, and we've come back. But he said, everybody's so happy.
It was
fantastic.
I mean, it must be the most popular Labour's ever been.
Yes, it probably was. Yeah. And I remember I went to the department, and some of the staff would sort of line the staircase to clap me in.
I mean, they're wonderful memories. I mean, for politicians, when politics can be so harsh, and when it can be so difficult, personally, politically, those special moments must be so vivid.
One of the other things I remember well is that I'd found it, I used to get this vast number of boxes with lots and lots and lots of letters, lots of correspondence. This is quite a struggle. Why is there quite so much of it? And then one of my private officers sort of said gently, it wasn't like this before. You know, we didn't have all this massive correspondence under the previous government, but we do now.
And that what when you is that because that was effectively fan mail?
Not necessarily fan mail, and lots of it was wanting us to do things, you know. I think it's just there was an enormous amount of work coming in. And I think people perhaps had stopped bothering to send the previous government things. I just don't know. I don't know what it was.
I remember hearing at the time that when Labour come in 1997, I think it's Robin Butler is allocating the Grace and Favour accommodation. And he apologises to you and your husband, Leo, for giving you such a small one-bed flat. And I think you said at the time, the hallway was bigger than your home at the time.
Well, certainly than our flat in London. But yeah, we used to have receptions and things there, you know. I would say to people, you know, they said, this is a one-bedroom flat without, I'm afraid, an ensuite bathroom, was the phraseology. The living room alone was bigger by far than our sort of little flat in London, the sort of broom cupboard flat. I think the hall was as well. All the rooms in that flat were huge.
It must have been incredible for that change when you'd been an opposition MP that whole time.
Yeah.
To go from.
I lost in 1979, but when I came back in 1983, then I was in opposition after that.
And actually, when you were MP for Lincoln, I have a confession to make. I was the organiser for Lincoln many years ago.
Oh, right.
And would occasionally work out of the Lincoln Labour Club, in which were at that point, so this is around 2007, 2006, 2005, old election addresses from when you were Margaret Jackson. And I am not ashamed to say that I pilfered a few and have them in a box in at the back of a wardrobe here. So I have some of your old campaign literature, should you wish to be reunited with it.
That's very kind.
Do you keep stuff like that?
A bit. You always keep the odd one or two. Where it all is, heaven only knows, in the garage probably.
And when, obviously, you first stood the Lincoln seat as Margaret Jackson, and then you're back as Margaret Beckett, obviously because you become married. Was that something you ever thought of not doing? Did you think, well, I've established myself as Margaret Jackson, I'm going to stick to that?
Well, we had a conversation about it because various people said to me, you know, you've established an identity as Margaret Jackson. And I remember one of my colleagues saying to me, my mother asked me the other day, what happened to that nice Margaret Jackson? Because she thought you were rather good. And I had to explain to her that you actually were back. So several people said, you know, whatever you do, keep your maiden name. And we discussed it, but there were a couple of things. One was we thought probably my father-in-law wouldn't understand. But then Leo had the thought that, well, actually, Beckett is further up the voting paper, which it is. And it does make a difference. So that was a clinching argument. Yeah, that's it. Right. I'll change my name.
You should have married a man with a surname A. That would have been ideal. Andrew Adonis, maybe.
Well, maybe.
So I wanted to ask you about the 1994 leadership contest, because that must have been so hard for your deputy leader at the time, John Smith, passes away. Just the shock to the party, to the country, to a group of friends and close colleagues. Having to run a leadership contest against the backdrop of that death must have been so difficult. I mean, in a way, the whole thing must have felt slightly inappropriate.
Well, first of all, of course, we had the European elections. I mean, John died on the eve of a set of European elections. And one of the things that when I became deputy, John said to me, I want you to be a real deputy. I didn't quite know what that meant. But anyway, I very soon discovered what he meant was he had a very clear view that there are these things that only the leader can do and that the leader must do, which is about, you know, getting and shaping your vision for the future and so on. But there were lots and lots and lots of routine things and meetings and things that the leader always did. And it was like sort of, so you'll do all of those and I'll do only the ones that I think are really essential. And he put me in charge of all campaigning as well. And so as it happens, I was absolutely involved in the planning for the European election campaign. And we had planned to do it as a dry run for the following, because it's the only other nationwide election. And so we planned to do it as a dry run for the then general election. So it wasn't too bad in that I knew what was supposed to be happening and why, but it's just that I had to do it instead of John doing it. And what I said was that, you know, we must not have any campaigning for the party leadership until after John's funeral and, you know, after those things had been settled, basically. Now, whether everybody obeyed it, that stricture is quite another matter. But, you know, that wasn't necessary. But you're right, it was an odd feeling because I was doing PMQs every week and that sort of thing, you know. And during the campaign, being the key person to do all the interviews. So it was a bit strange from that point of view.
You were really good at PMQs. Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
I mean, you were superb at it. You know, there is sort of footage out there if people search well enough. But one of the great performers at the dispatch box and just a really great, calm way of holding a government to account. And it's a shame that we didn't see more of you getting to do that, really.
Thank you. Well, you know, I did enjoy it. And there was one day I remember that we decided we were going to try and put John Major on the spot about VAT. And we discussed it back and forth. And so, you know, I'll challenge him, and of course he won't. And then over lunchtime, because this was in the morning, I suddenly thought, what happens if he says yes?
Yeah.
And so my advice to anybody who's doing that thing is always, whatever you do before you finish, think about what you'll do if you get the answer you're not expecting. And I came to the conclusion that if he did, there was, you know, I knew what would happen. The house would explode with laughter. Everybody would go, nah, 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 nah. You weren't expecting that, were you? And it would be a hit and you would look silly. But there was nothing to be done about it. You know, you just have to take it. If that's what happened, and think of a way to take it on. But anyway, fortunately, that didn't happen.
That is such good advice, because I can think of moments. I remember Tony Blair outfoxed William Hague with a similar thing once, and I think Cameron did it to Ed Miliband. And you can't help... The problem is, because of the way that Parliament is set up and broadcast, you watch it as a tennis match. It's a form of kind of political sport. And as a viewer, wherever your own political allegiances are, when you get a moment like that, if you do, it's impossible not to go, well, they won that one. You know, somewhere on a chalkboard, that counts for something, however small.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you just have to, you know, you have to understand, you know, the leader of the opposition is, at the moment, it's particularly important perhaps to say this, the leader of the opposition is supposed to lose at Prime Minister's question time. The Prime Minister has all the cards. The leader of the opposition has only got a limited number of questions. Once they've had their allocation, they can't come back. They're not supposed to make any statements. They're only supposed to ask questions. All the cards are in the Prime Minister's hands.
Did you have any other approaches or techniques for PMQs then? I remember sometimes William Hague would only ask five questions so that Tony Blair wouldn't get to use his big punchline at the end, or he'd skip around letters of the alphabet to try and, you know, fox him. I think Hague had a unique approach to it. Were there any tricks of the trade that you had, or any rules?
I didn't particularly do that. I always, what I tried to do was to be as succinct as possible. And to really kind of, you know, get to the thing that you wanted to expose them on.
One thing you were really good at was that I think they struggle to deal with you. You know, there are certain opponents that prime ministers like who they can drag into a bit of a scrap. And I think Cameron enjoyed going up against Ed Miliband and having Ed Balls there. And I think Blair and Hague, as much as they probably kind of feared each other, there was a kind of sense that was quite pugilistic. But you can never be drawn. You were never drawn into a fight. So they could never make it messy with you. I don't know if that was something you were aware of.
Not particularly, no. But yeah. And of course, the part of the other thing is that I had been politically John Major's opposite number through a number of portfolios, as it happened, because when he got his first ministerial job, he was shadowing Social Security. He was doing Social Security and I was shadowing Social Security. So we had a lot of history of being on opposite sides of the dispatch box on the same subject. So I was sort of accustomed to being up against him. That might have helped.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
And then in 1994, you're acting leader of the opposition, you're acting leader of the Labour Party, you're standing for the deputy leadership and the leadership. In retrospect, do you think you'd have stood a better chance of becoming or remaining deputy if you'd have just stood for the deputy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, people more or less said, you know, you're guaranteed to get the deputy if you only stand for that. But I didn't want to. And, you know, I'll be quite frank about it. There were two reasons, really. I mean, I stood for it because I was prepared to do it if that's what the party wanted. But I had a feeling the party had got used to the idea of John and me as a leadership team. And I had a feeling that they would want a new leadership team so that, you know, they would be looking to move on. I was confident that the relationship with Tony wouldn't be the same. We got on perfectly well, but until I stood against him, he wasn't very pleased about that. But there was no way that Tony was going to be saying, look, all these things a leader normally does, you know, you do, because I don't need to do them. He was bound to be going to do all that sort of thing himself. So it was going to be a very, very different job with probably less real work and real influence in it. but all the sort of dog's body stuff, you know. So I thought it wasn't going to be the same job at all. And also, I, perhaps at this stage in my life and career, I can be quite blunt about it. Tony had two best friends, Peter and Gordon. And I thought you'd have one looking over one shoulder and one looking over the other.
One's looking, are they looking at each other over each other's shoulder, or are they protecting him from both sides?
Well, they certainly would both have been wanting to, you know, have much more influence and a role than me. So I thought I would be well out of it, but John Prescott would probably kill me for saying that.
I mean, it's a pretty brutal assessment, really, that when you're saying you think the party would have wanted to move on, you'd only been deputy leader for 2 years. And obviously, this leadership election is triggered by the sad death of John Smith. But Labour was making progress from the election in those 2 years. Oh. It was further on in the polls. It was more likely to win. I mean, just dealing with John Smith and what if in 1997, do you think Labour would have won with John Smith?
Oh, yes, definitely. Paddy Ashcroft told me after John had died that the night before John died, literally, we had a fundraising gala dinner. And, you know, John was, there was media going in and that kind of thing. And Paddy Ashcroft told me that he'd seen John on the evening news. And he said to his wife, I mean, just look at him, you know, you can see he's a prime minister.
And how would history have been different had Labour won with John Smith in 97? Do you think the victory would have been as big and Labour would have stayed in office for so long? How would his administration have differed from the Blair and Brown years?
Really hard to judge. I mean, actually, the European elections immediately after John had died, we got an even bigger result than in 1997. In fact, so big, and I perhaps shouldn't say this, but there was one person who won. And when the media asked about him, nobody in party headquarters knew who he was. So little had we expected to win that seat, which was quite awkward. There was tremendous warmth towards John. We might not have won with the same margin by then, but because, you know, it was a completely different approach. But yes, I'm sure we would have won.
And when you announced that you're standing for the leadership in 1994, now that whole election is seen through the lens of Blair and Brown and the deal and Granita and what it does to Labour history from that point on. How did Tony Blair take it when you told him that you were going to stand?
Wasn't terribly pleased. I mean, I think certainly the people around Tony, shall we say, what they wanted was a coronation. They didn't really want anybody to stand against him. Or if anybody did, they wanted it to be somebody who he could absolutely, you know, beat hollow, which indeed he did. They were not happy at all. But there you go.
And did he ever pick up the phone and say, look, Margaret, come on. You know, look, don't stand against me. I'll make you Foreign Secretary or, you know, whatever you want, but come on, let's not have a row.
No, he never did. I did get various menacing messages, but no, Tony never spoke to me about it.
He says in his book, when he's considering the outcome of the deputy leadership, where obviously you're standing for the leadership and the deputy leadership, I wrote the quote down. He says about the possibility of you becoming deputy leader as opposed to John Prescott.
Well, this is news to me because one of the other things I don't do is I don't go through any of these books looking to see what they say about me. So go on.
Well, here we go. I'm about to.
Something I don't know now.
Years after it was published, here we go. He says, I wasn't so sure about Margaret. I liked and respected her, but if things got really ugly, I wasn't sure she would step up and throw a protective cordon around me, whereas John Prescott, I thought, would do so. I mean, is that fair?
I know he was, because one of my own staff heard it being said. Well, I know he was being told that I wasn't trustworthy. It's nice of him to put it like that.
But is that you weren't politically trustworthy, or you think he was going to go through his wallet or anything like that?
No, politically, yes. Yeah. I think the thing is, you would not have been able to rely on me to say something was right that I thought was totally wrong. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'd go quiet and I accept the collective decision making and so on. But I would always fight my corner for what I thought we ought to do, even if it wasn't always comfortable. So they may have thought I would be less accepting of some of the things they wanted to do than John Prescott would have been. He wasn't like that either.
He makes you foreign secretary late on in his premiership, which, according to all the accounts, was a real surprise to you.
Absolutely. I had no idea. I mean, normally, like everybody, well, for a start, the media always, I remember thinking the same thing about Tony Newton, actually, who was my opposite number for a while. Every time there was a reshuffle, and the media has a reshuffle every July. The Prime Minister doesn't necessarily, but the media always do. When the Tories were in power, they would always say, and of course Tony Newton will go, because I mean, he's been there for ages. And I'm like, well, I mean, why does anybody keep him? Like, they kept him because he was good at his job and he didn't cause trouble. And they always said, you know, and of course Margaret Beckett will be going in this reshuffle. And so, you know, a lot of the time I thought, well, probably I would be. But as it happened, quite fortuitously, that particular year, I thought he was less likely to sack me than normal, because I'd had a very hectic end of the year. I remember I was at Cabinet in sort of fairly early November, and I asked Hilary Armstrong, who was the chief whip at the time, when we were going to meet close to Christmas, and she told me. So at the end of the Cabinet, I said, oh, by the way, can I just say to everybody, Happy Christmas, because from here on in, I shall be in... I can't remember what the sequence was. I think it was I was in Brussels doing the sugar negotiations. Then I was going to Montreal to do the climate change negotiations, which paved the way. If we hadn't got agreement in Montreal, there would have been no Paris deal, because there would have been nothing to discuss. There was no follow-on to the Kyoto Protocol. So I went from the sugar negotiations in Brussels to Montreal for climate change, and then I went to Hong Kong for the World Trade Organization negotiations. So, you know, I shan't be seeing any of you until we get back just before Christmas. I had heard, nobody said anything much to me, but I had heard it said by one of my colleagues that Tony had said at Cabinet that I'd done a tremendous job on, particularly the agriculture policy negotiations. I thought probably I was less likely to be sacked in that reshuffle than in some of the previous ones. But I'd no idea what he would do, whether he would leave me at DEFRA or whether he would move me. And I was quite sanguine about it. So I said to him, actually, I've no idea, but if you want to leave me at DEFRA, you know, I don't mind. And he said, I want you to go on working on climate change and making it a big, important feature of the of government policy, but I want you to do it at the Foreign Office.
And what did you say?
Something four-letter and not very polite.
And how did? But you weren't telling him to F off. That was just like a surprise exclamation.
Oh, yes.
And how did he take it?
He giggled, as I recall.
I mean, usually people say they know if they're going to get fired because you get invited to the Prime Minister's office in the Commons. They don't make you walk up Downing Street for a dismissal. So if you're invited to come in through the front door, you probably knew you were safe.
Well, I don't know. I didn't think about it particularly from that point of view.
But taking on that brief at that time, I mean, it's one of the great offices of state. You were at the time only the second woman to hold a great office of state, the only previous one being Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister. Yeah. So the first Labour woman to hold a great office of state.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... I don't know what goes through your mind when you get made Foreign Secretary. You'd been an experienced cabinet minister for many years until then. Did that feel, even within that distinguished career, significant and special?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was quite a shock. It just hadn't occurred to me, you know, I hadn't thought about it. I remember I went back to my own department to pick up my stuff, back to DEFRA, that is. Where my private secretary greeted me with afternoon foreign secretary. And as I was leaving the building to go straight off to the Foreign Office, I ran into one of my officials who'd been one of the experts on sugar negotiations, tremendous guy. We had a great team doing those negotiations. And I said, this is your fault. You lot did all did such a good job in the negotiations. That's why I'm going to the Foreign Office. And he giggled and he said, they won't know what's hit them.
Well, did you know what hit you? Because people are fascinated with, I think particularly, the Treasury and the Foreign Office. They feel almost like republics. They have their own power structure and their own culture. And they feel there's a kind of secrecy and an old-fashionedness about them. I don't know if that's something you felt, whether it was compared to being DTI or DEFRA, that the Foreign Office has a kind of grandeur about it.
Yes, I think that's true. And one of the things that I thought I found, well, first of all, I had a warning from somebody I'd met on the circuit, who was a senior Foreign Office official, that there were people in the Foreign Office who didn't think a woman ought to be Foreign Secretary. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my word. And this is 2006, seven?
Absolutely. It surprised me slightly. And she didn't mean everybody, but, you know, so there were senior people who do not think you should be there. But, of course, I had a sort of, I had a baptism of fire, which really kind of got me off to a flying start, because Tony appointed me on the Friday afternoon, and I was in Washington, I think it was. Yes, Washington. On the Monday for a meeting of the Iran negotiating group. So that was the foreign ministers of Russia, China, France, Germany, America, and myself. And we were due to have dinner together to talk about the deal that we were discussing to offer Iran so that they would stop pursuing nuclear enrichment. So initially it was drinks, ministers on their own, and officials were outside, and they said to me, it'll be all right, you know, be about half an hour over drinks, you've read the brief anyway, and then after half an hour, you know, it'll be you and us as well, and so you'll be fine. So I went into these drinks, and about 2 hours later we and all the civil servants were there, white-faced, especially, and nothing civil servants hate more than their ministers being off their leash and they don't know what they're saying. And I suppose mine were probably particularly petrified, I don't know. But basically what had happened was that Condi had got an agreement to move the American position dramatically. And so that's why we were there talking for 2 hours. And then we went into dinner and the conversation went on. And it all went fine, I thought. So it was quite a sort of baptism of fire. And in fact, it probably must have gone all right because they asked me to chair the next meeting of that group.
And it's, but the Foreign Secretary has the elements. It's the closest thing to Prime Minister in many ways. You're dealing with other senior governments abroad. It's Britain on the global stage. Mm. Did you enjoy that element of it?
Yes, I did. Yes. Well, I thought about it quite a lot, because one of the things that, you know, you're always conscious of at the Foreign Office is that there are people in that building who know to their fingertips about the area of the world that they have, areas of the world, if you like, that they've been responsible for, probably speak the language and all that kind of thing. And you think, well, all these tremendous experts, so what can a minister bring to that? And I came very quickly to the conclusion that what a minister could bring was the personal relationships that you can develop with others, you know, other presidents or prime ministers or foreign secretaries. And that's what I concentrated on. If I'd concentrated rather more on the British media and less on my job, I might have lasted there longer. But as it was, I concentrated on building good relationships, which on the whole I have reason to think I did, because once you're not in the job anymore, they don't have to ask you to do things. But people went on being in touch for quite a long time.
I was working for Labour at the time in the East Midlands region. Of course, you were and still are one of the MPs for Labour in the region. I remember the Lebanon war starting, and one of those things when you're working for a political party and your friends in the pub are saying, why aren't Labour talking about this? And I just remember there was a period of time where it felt like the government wasn't vocal. Now, as a member of staff, I didn't know what was going on because I wasn't employed by the government. I was employed by the party. And it's one of those things where, you know, your loyalty to the party pulls you through. You say, well, I'm sure there's stuff going on. I mean, What's your recollection of that? Because there was a perception at the time that perhaps the British government wasn't particularly vocal about what was happening.
Yeah, I know. And actually, it's a really interesting example. I think I found it interesting. There are moments, and it can happen under any government, there are moments when the media decide what it is you've got to do. And that was one of them. I remember another one, and you know John Sargent, who was the BBC long serving, very respected correspondent. I remember him saying this about the fuel strike.
Yes,
he said, and every day he said, we're all there at the press conferences, and we're all demanding that the government make this pledge, and we know you can't. You know, we know it would be absolutely the wrong thing for you to do. But there we all are hammering away, you know, and saying, well, you know, you must commit yourself to doing this, government. And he said, and then I suddenly thought, oh, but wouldn't it be terrible if they did? Because, you know, it is absolutely the wrong thing to do. But it's the story, you know, it's the story. But it would be terrible if they gave way to it. It was one of those. And the media decided that we had to use, and I'm not even sure I can remember, that we had to use a particular phrase about unconditional ceasefire on both sides. And if you didn't use that, it didn't matter what else you said. You know, it probably wasn't even reported, which would be one of the reasons why people like you. But, you know, you could say we want to see an end of violence. You could see we want to, you know, no more bloodshed. It didn't matter what you said. And we were, all of us, to be fair, the Russians and everybody as well, we were all saying we want the conflict to stop. But unless you use those words, and what we knew was that the particular form of words conveyed the impression that it was really the Israelis who had to stop. That Hezbollah didn't necessarily have to, they were only poor little Hezbollah, but the Israelis had to stop any military action. And we knew that, I used the analogy to somebody once, that if one of your friends is in a very bitter divorce, you know, and you're hearing things from both sides, and you're trying maybe to be a bit of a peacemaker and help to calm things down, but there may be a phrase, and if you use it, your friend will think, that's it. You haven't got a bloody clue. You do not understand what is going on. And after that, that's it. You can't have any, can't be any good, because you shut out, you don't understand. And using that particular phrase would have meant the Israeli government was like, oh yeah, typical. Well, no, nobody understands. And they'd have stopped listening. And we were able, in fact, to mitigate things because they had not stopped listening to us. And of course, in the British media, it was all kind of, we've lost all influence in the Middle East, you know, nobody wants anything to do with us anymore. At that precise period, one of the most senior and experienced Middle East foreign ministers said to me, you have to stay involved. We need your wisdom and experience. I don't think he meant me, he meant the British government, you know, the Foreign Office. We need your wisdom and experience. And all of the people, all of the international visitors who were all going into Lebanon and making pronouncements and all that kind of thing, they were all going in via us, because we were the only people who were trusted by both sides enough to have a bit of a rite of passage. So it was all nonsense. But it was, and I remember doing the Today programme, and whoever it was, the interviewer, said, so you're happy for bloodshed to continue? And I thought, well, I thought various four-letter things that I won't sully your ears with. But, I mean, it was ridiculous, because we were calling all the time for the conflict to stop. And if you didn't say that phrase that they decided was the phrase, everything was dismissed. It's a very useful lesson in politics, actually. And as I say, it can happen to any government, and it does.
And Labour's relationship with the Middle East, I think particularly of Iraq and then the Corbyn years, Israel and Palestine, for certainly the last 5 or 6 years, but sort of a dominant theme in Labour politics in a way that back then I would just never have guessed would have happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the situation has deteriorated very badly since then. I mean, one of the things that Tony gets no credit for at all, Tony tried very, very, very hard to get George Bush to take an intervening and science stance and pursuing American policy. And I think Bush was interested in doing what Tony had done in Northern Ireland. But maybe it's impossible. Maybe an American president never can. I don't know. But he was happy for Condé to do it, but he himself just didn't engage in the way that Tony and the Irish Prime Minister did in Northern Ireland. So they didn't make the progress.
Security and issues around intelligence are still something really close to your heart. You're the chair of the Joint Committee on National Security Strategy. What do you think in the year 2021 is the greatest threat to our security in the UK?
Well, there are half a dozen that the government has identified as tier one risks. One of them is a pandemic, because, you know, we've had this one and hopefully we're getting to the stage where we may be able to overcome it. But I think one of the things that is difficult for any government to assess and to get right is that what you tend to do is to focus on the threats that you know about. You know, are you worried about China? Are you worried about Russia? These are potential perceived threats. But sometimes there are things that just come out of the blue that are actually sort of accidents. They aren't maliciously driven by foreign states or whatever. They're the things that can catch you on the hop.
The unknown unknowns, to quote Donald Rumsfeld.
But I suppose of them all, I would say climate change is the biggie, because one of the things that is so alarming about climate change, and thank goodness people are recognising it now more than they ever did in the past. And I remember explaining this to the cabinet at one point, you can get to a tipping point, at which point, let's say the classic is Greenland ice, all the Greenland ice melts or something. You won't know you've got to it until it's already gone. There's nothing that tells you this is a tipping point. You may say this could be, we could be approaching a tipping point. We must try at all costs to avoid it. But you don't know how big a risk you're running. I tried to get the department actually, but it was too early in the science for it to be available to do me a map of the United Kingdom with what our boundaries would be, what our coastline would be if some of these things happened. You know, I was planning to go to the cabinet and say, there you are, Charles, there's Norwich-on-Sea. Anyway, they said the science wasn't in a strong enough state to do that at that point in time. So it was a bit of a shame. It would have been a nice way of telling the cabinet that it was really something that in each of their departments they had to take seriously.
I wonder you've had such a distinguished and long and successful career in politics in so many different areas. Just, I want to really get the advantage of that wonderful, amazing career in a number of ways. Firstly, just with Labour, why do you think Labour have never elected a woman to lead it?
I think it's just accident. I mean, to my mind, the first woman Prime Minister should have been Barbara Castle, not Margaret Thatcher. And that was accident in the Conservative Party. I mean, don't let anybody kid you that the Conservatives set out to elect a woman. They didn't. And what's more, when they had elected her, nobody remembers this. She was a terrible leader of the opposition. She was so bad, it was embarrassing. She was pathetic at Prime Minister's Question Time. And when she made a speech, it was especially before they got her to lower her voice, she would gabble her way through it, and unkind people on our benches, because I always say, if you got rid of all the other blood sports, it'd still be the House of Commons. Unkind people on our side would shout faster, faster, and she'd go faster and gabble her way through her speech. And they were horrible about her. They called her the cultured pearl, which was really quite a vicious description. And, you know, she was really, really terrible. But I forgot why I got into that story.
About why Labour had never elected a female leader.
So in the end, they couldn't stomach Ted Heath. And they felt, I think, quite bitter about the fact that none of the men would run against Ted Heath in a way which was really potentially to bring him down. And they were very angry about it. And she had, you know, she had good advisors, and I think whether they really knew what they were doing is another matter. And they certainly didn't set out to have a woman. They drifted into it through circumstances. And similarly, the Labour Party has never found itself in a position where there was quite the right person at quite the right time. But, you know, having said that, Well, look at Hillary Clinton. I mean, you know, all those years of saying that you can't have a woman because, you know, they haven't built up the experience and all this kind of thing. The most experienced presidential candidate probably in American history and the most expected to win. Didn't happen.
And did you, have you ever experienced sexism in the Labour Party? Did you experience it when you stood in 94?
Yes, I suppose I did. But I mean, nobody said you can't have a woman leader. They just said, you know, we've got one Margaret, we don't want another one.
Really? Was that a kind of common refrain?
It was a semi-joke, but, you know, to be fair to them, you know, they said, there's Margaret Thatcher, you know, we want somebody different. And a smart young man was different from Margaret Thatcher.
My word. You are different from Margaret Thatcher in so many ways.
One of my jokes in my leadership speeches in the hustings was that it would give our people it would give the Tories an opportunity to march shouting Maggie 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 out out out. People laughed at the joke, but it didn't make them vote for me.
And what are the major changes you've seen? I mean, you served Wilson and Callaghan, and we haven't talked about that at all. What are the major changes you've seen in British politics since you were first elected in Lincoln?
Well, there are so many. The whole Europe saga is one where, you know, we weren't initially in Europe when I was first elected. And then we became very, very influential in the European Union. We really did maximise our power and influence. And then, you know, we've come out of it. I think one of the things that has perhaps changed more dramatically than any of those big things is the whole social media thing, which is transforming the way that MPs can work and have to work, like it's transforming everything else in life. You know, the way in which there's such total exposure. I mean, nowadays, you sort of recommend people who want to come into politics to take a look at their social media records and expunge them or whatever. And also, because there were so few women when I was first elected, I never had to cultivate the media. I never had to call. It was very bad for me, I'm sure, because, you know, I didn't need to, so I didn't. Because, you know, there was a sort of, well, what can we do on here? Oh, well, we could have a woman. And then you looked around and how many women were there? And there were so few women that even after 83, I think, up until 87, if they had a photo call for women MPs, you only had to look around. You knew whether we were all there or not.
And how do you feel about social media? Do you go on it?
No.
Why not? No,
life's too short.
I wish more people agreed.
I mean, you know, and I remember one of my colleagues a while ago saying, oh, you know, it's wonderful. I can tell everybody what I'm doing all day. And I'm saying, you can tell everybody what you're doing all day and every day? Push off. I freely admit I am scarred. I don't mean badly, but I am very much affected by being the youngest in a family of powerful women. My mother and my two elder sisters, who were quite a bit older than me. And so everybody had an opinion about what I ought to be doing, which was usually not what I was doing or what I wanted to be doing. And so I grew up absolutely kind of, if anybody used to say to me, you know, what are you doing? So and so, I said, why do you want to know? Everybody always had an opinion about why I should be doing something else, and everything was a wrangle. So, you know, that is me, and it's bad, I know. But it means that, one of the things that you do learn early on in politics, or if you don't, you should, is that if you're not very careful, politics is a way of life. It's neither, I get quite impatient with people who talk about, well, politicians are just like you know, any other profession. No, they're not. You know, okay, if you're a much-loved doctor or surgeon or judge or whatever, there's a circle in which you'll be known. But you're not somebody who might be stopped by people when you get on the train and abused or whatever. And it's really not the same. And you have to preserve some space, both for yourself and for your family and friends, because otherwise, you know, it will destroy you. it easily could destroy you, because you could, there are more things that people would like you to do than any human being could do. And that's if you don't have any kind of private life at all. So when I heard, this is wonderful, there's this thing you can go on Twitter and you have to express everything you want to say in 140 words. I don't think so. And then, Facebook, well, you can share all your family photographs. Oh, thanks. We don't even take photographs, Leo and I. He says sometimes, he went to China 3 times and came back without a single photograph. What is it interested in really to other people? Here's a photograph of me and so-and-so in Beijing. Oh, yeah, really interesting, yeah.
Well, I agree. Margaret, thank you so much. We didn't talk about the Heath or the Callaghan years. It'd be great to get you back on at some point in the future to talk about those if you're interested in it. But in closing, thank you so much for coming on. And hopefully, as things start to open up now and people can move around, it won't be too long before you can go on another caravan holiday.
That would be very nice.
Do you have anywhere in particular planned?
Well, when we caravan nowadays, we've caravaned in various places, but nowadays we tend to go to France. There was a brief moment when I worried about that, because I thought if the French know and hate any British minister, it's the Minister of Agriculture. But we managed to get away with it incognito pretty much.
Margaret, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Wasn't that Europe answer superb in so many ways? But just for placing Margaret's political life and the scale of it into a context, when Margaret first became an MP, Britain had not yet entered the European Union. And here we are in 2021, having left, and Margaret is still an MP. Just remarkable timescale. And so many brilliant answers. All the stuff about reshuffles is great. All the stuff about the pressures on ministers. Why the British government sometimes chooses forms of words that may infuriate different elements of the public or indeed the media, I thought was a great insight and so well told. And there's just something about Margaret and her manner, and there's something about, obviously I think it's always fascinating the people who manage to endure and stay and the stamina they require and the personal qualities that they possess. And I think sometimes in politics, we can be fooled by those that are more openly bullish and a bit, maybe macho is not the right word, maybe a bit more combative. Margaret Beckett has a particular style, a particular steel, highly dignified, rock solid, really clear thinker, really clear about where she stands and the way that she handles herself. And all those things that's why she was so good at the dispatch box. When she did PMQs, all that those sort of ingredients that make up the politician, that make up the person as well, those unique attributes are why she has endured when so many others have not been able to, and is still in there, still possesses that desire and that hunger to change the world for the better. And of course, has the ability to make those, to turn those values into policies, or to put her skills to the service of the party, but also of the country in the role that she does now. So that was just such a pleasure. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on iTunes. And if you've got a recommendation for a future guest or a suggestion, put it in the review and pop it up, and I will try and get some of those people booked. For now, I shall leave you to it. What a treat that's been. I'll see you soon. Ta-ra.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.